Hello, everyone. My name is Elijah David, minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Sanitarian Congregation Mount Zion at the 12th Hour in the Liberty Hill, Texas. Today is May 4, 2014, or it is if 6, 2018. We'll start our second service today with a song entitled, Oh Worship the King. Oh worship the King, how glorious above. I'm gratefully sing His wonderful love. Our shield and defender, the Ancient of Days, pavilion in splendor and girded with praise. Oh, tell of His might and sing of His grace. Whose robe is the light, whose canopy spake. His chariots of wrath the deep thunder has rolled, and darkened the path on the wings of the storm. Thy bountiful care, what tongue can recite? Breeze in the air, it shines in the light. It streams from the hills, it descends to the plain, and sweetly distills in the dew and the rain. Fill children of dust and feeble as frail, in thee do we trust, nor find it to fail. Thy mercy, how tender, how firm to the end, our Maker, Defender, Redeemer, and Friend. Calling the Vanguard by the Brother Eddie Johnson. This is part number 12. We're going to continue where we left off. We're going to do just a little review of what we did on the last tape. It says on page 29, it says, the earth in the prophecy represents the United States, which is the work of the judgment. Okay, now, do a little correction there. Said for the earth in the prophecy represents the United States, which is the place for the work of the judgment for the living to take place. And Brother Sean says in the 11th hour, but since how 11th hour is then come and gone, and there are 12 hours a day, Yahshua says in John 11:9, there's 12 hours a day. So he's, Brother Sonson is only making a prophecy then for the 12th hour, because he's believing that the 11th hour is the last hour of the day anyway, so we're just putting number 12 in there, and Brother Sonson has been coming down and moved on. He's gone to the grave, and so he's awaiting some resurrection. I don't know whether it's all together, but I believe that it's not going to be good. Anyway, he says that this work for the judgment of the living in the 12th parabolic hour, which is the movement that follows the branch Davidian. Now watch this, shepherd's rod. Okay. With the continuation of the shepherd's rod message. Now keep in mind that Vitihadas, name of the second step of the genuine movement of the seventh day. I want to straighten something else out. Brother Johnson calls Mount Gilead his place. He called it a movement. He calls Vitihadas a movement. No, these are steps of the genuine movement. Your genuine movement is your seventh day Adventist movement. That's called at the end of the ninth hour in 1844. And the Pearl of Matthew 20 points out that that ninth hour group of laborers, there's only one movement for them, and that's the Seventh-day Adventist movement. And but they had extensions. They had steps of their genuine movement. And they had three feeding pastures. Because if Vidyaholic was a genuine movement of its own, it would be in the program Matthew 20. They say, okay, the Matthew 20 would say the ninth hour call labors, which inspiration showed to be the seventh day Adventist in 1844. Then it showed, the tenth hour, or something like that for the Shepherd Rod movement. And then it would show the 11th hour for the Brother Stevie Johnson movement. But it didn't do that. It just showed the three steps of the genuine movement. They had new messages for the Mother Church, and they had an addition to their original name, Seventh-day Adventists. They were called Davidian Seventh-day Adventists. In other words, when you say it's time for the Davidites to come on the scene, you're talking about it's time for Judah now to take charge and rule over the 12 tribes. That's all you're saying. When you add that David to the Seventh-day Adventist Davidic, then you're saying it's time for the tribe of Judah now to take over and the church of the Seventh-day Adventist. Be the leader. Be the lawgiver. Be the one with the inspiration, and be the one for the bringing forth and restoring of this here antipical temple. And that's exactly what Judah did when she came over here in 1930. Her progression was that step by step she would bring forth and restore the sanctuary system that was prophesied by Ellen G. White in 1844, that at the end of the 2300 days prophecy that ended in 1844 with the cleansing of the sanctuary, Daniel 8:14, and starting the judgment of the dead. That also was for the announcing of the restoration of the sanctuary. Okay, so the third step of the genuine movement with Brother Johnson in 1970, it restored the sanctuary system that was prophesied in 1844. Would be restored by the Adventists, not anyone else. So Brother Johnson was right when he named his church in 1970, 11th Hour Adventist Remnant Church. Or 1977, actually. But anyway, he named it 11th Hour Adventist Remnant Church. Okay. So, shows that he strictly was of the fourth group of laborers and part of Mama. Okay. So now it says, he's saying that in 1 TGR 28, page 15, this shows that the kingdom, the harvest, the judgment for the living, and the restoration of all things takes place in the earth during the 11th hour. Now, you know, this is a prophetic in a sense, because what happened in the 11th hour at Kermit? Brother Johnson raised up the tabernacle of David that had fallen down after many centuries, and he restored the sanctuary system, put it back into full operation with a creation calendar, a quick time for the keeping of the holy days, the additional holy days as added to the 7-day Sabbath, and he restored the health laws and the sacred name and the daily and the forgiveness article, and he restored all the feast days to the 7-day Sabbath, put the sanctuary back into full operation. So that's the beginning of the restoration of all things. But he didn't bring forth a purified kingdom, so that means that he laid the foundation for the restoration of the everlasting temple, the antitype of Solomon's temple that he built in the name of his father, David. Okay, so when you bring forth the first harvest and the first judgment out of Gilead's center that represented the Seventh-day Adventist church, then what happens? you set up the house of David. That will in the eighth movement would bring forth the purified congregation that would have, and that would be proven by the 144,000 then coming forth and showing that we're on time in the right time and the right hour with the right leader for the restoration of all things. And until you have the harvest, until you have some fruit to show for your labors of planting the seed and cultivating it and nourishing it until it becomes ripe, then you can't say that you've fully restored anything. If you don't have fruit, if you don't produce fruit, when you harvest fruit and you put it in the barn, and then the restoration then has been successful. Okay, so now Brother Johnson goes on to say that when the work of the harvest, the judgment for the living, the teaching of the gospel, or declared unto all nations of the kingdom, is finished in the earth, USA. He says the 11th hour will be over. So he's saying the 11th hour is the last hour, so the only thing you're looking at now is just going to the promised land in Israel, where the kingdom of heaven has come down, and you're in the kingdom. You're in heaven, in a heavenly kingdom, and you're in eternity. And probation is closed for the world at the end of the 11th hour. That's in essence what he's teaching. So you see how the devil just tricked Yahweh's prophets and different ones that he placed in charge of the candlestick with inspiration. Limited inspiration, but they had inspiration. Or they also couldn't fulfill the work that they were called to do if they didn't have inspiration. So anyway, they only had inspiration for what they were called to do. When they stepped outside of the boundaries of that, then they got in trouble. If the house stepped out of the boundaries of the inspiration was given to him, and he had loads of inspiration. If you just read all his writings, you would know that man had lots of inspiration. Okay, so now it says, when the work of the harvest, the judgment for the living, the gospel of the kingdom, is finished in the earth, United States, the 11th hour will be over, and the judicial tribunal that was moved to the earth during the half hour silence at the opening of the seventh seal. And he says now in 1970, will at the end of the 11th hour be moved to Jerusalem. So the beginning of the 11th hour, then Brother Johnson failed to put down, it was in 1970. So at the opening of the seventh seal in 1970. But then what was revealed when the seventh seal was opened up? Everything from Revelation chapter 8 through 22. That's what was opened up in that seventh seal. If Rose indeed had that seventh seal opened up to him, then here's what he'd be teaching. I'm going to read it to you from the Revelation. Now the seventh seal, like I told you, starts with Revelation chapter 8. And it says, and when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before the Yahweh, and unto them were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer. And there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. Now this is a scene for the judgment of the living, alright. Alright, and verse 4, and the smoke of the incense, which came with the prayers of the saints, ascended up for Yahweh out of the angel's hand. And so you only have the smoke of the incense ascending before the Father on the Day of Atonement, and that's done by the high priest. And Yahshua, being the high priest, is the one that has to offer up our prayers with the incense from off the altar only on the Day of Atonement, once a year. So you see, these are the things that Brother Johnson would have been on top of if the seventh seal had truly opened up to him. just before he'd be telling you, that's what he'd been telling us in 1970. Okay, but he didn't know. He didn't have inspiration on this. But yet he said the seventh seal opened up with him. Why would Yahweh call a prophet and give him a message and open it up, say it's opened up, and then the prophet ended up not understanding what's in the message? And then went forward and tried to teach the truth with no understanding of the message that was given to him. That's exactly what happened to Ben Roden. That's what happened to Brother Johnson. Two of them right in a row. They were given a message. At least they said they were. And if indeed they were given a message, but then how come they didn't understand the content of it? All right, now it goes on to further say in Revelation 8, verse 5, and the angel took the censer, filled it with the fire of the altar, and only a high priest can do that in the sanctuary. So who's this angel? This is Yahshua, the high priest. And he cast it into the earth. That's the United States in prophecy. This is where the judgment of the living began, right here in Texas. Began with at Gilead Center with Kermit, with Willis W. Johnson. And there were voices and thunders and lightnings and earthquakes. Alright? And the seven angels, which had the seven trumpets, prepared themselves to sound. For the first angel sounded, and there followed hail, and fire mingled with the blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of the trees was burned up, and all green grass was burned up. Now, you don't understand this unless you've had a study on the seven churches and the seven trumpets. Okay. That's the way that's going. In verse 8 of Revelation chapter 8, it says, and the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire, was cast into the sea. Then in verse 10 it says, the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven. Okay, and then verse 11 it says, and the same, and the name of Yeshua is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars, meaning that the two-thirds of the sun was left, two-thirds of the moon was left, and two-thirds of the stars were left in heaven. The rest were smitten. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld and heard an angel flying through the midst of the heaven, saying with a loud voice, woe, woe, woe unto the inhabitants of the earth, by the reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels which are yet to sound. Okay, now that's in the chapter 8 now, the seventh seal now being opened, it goes right on into chapter 9. It talks about there in chapter 9, verse 15, about the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for the slay of the third part of man. Okay, Lichihas, he talks about this, but this is what the seventh seal is to reveal. These are things supposed to happen when the seventh seal opens up. And it talks about in verse 16 of Revelation 9, here in the opening of the seventh seal, that the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them, having breastplates of fire, and Jansen and brimstone, and the heads of the horses were as the heads of the lions, and out of their mouth issued fire and smoke and brimstone. Then it says in verse 18, by these three were the third part of men killed by the fire, and by the smoke, and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouth. And for the powers in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents and had heads and with them they do hurt. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues, yet repent not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship the devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Okay, this is all in this takes place in the 12th hour, in the, when the seventh seal has been opened. So if the seventh seal opened in 1970, like Brother Johnson said it did, with at the beginning of the 11th hour with him, well then he never none of these things ever took place and happened. So that was quite an assertion that to say that that he was in charge of the seventh seal being opened up to him. Okay, Vita Holif, he talked all about these seven seals, and he's going to reveal what was in the seventh seal, the book of Revelation from chapter 8 to 22. Vita Holif revealed that, Rush didn't reveal that, and Vita Holif tried to interpret everything, and he did a good job, pretty much, on interpreting all the seven seals from Revelation 8 to 22. But everything that he interpreted was for the fulfillment in the 12th hour, and V.T. Holif interpreted the book of the seventh seal in the 10th parabolic hour. So, this is what I'm talking about. So, Brother Johnson, he's all wet, you see. Everything he's prophesied about here is for the 12th hour. And we've already been through that on the last tape, so I'm going to fast forward now to a new part of his track. We're on part... we're on part 12. It says on page 29 of Calling the Vanguard of Brother Study Johnson, "Thus saith the Yahshua of the host, it shall yet come to pass that there shall come people, and the inhabitants of many cities, and the inhabitants speedily to pray before the Yahweh, and to seek the Yahshua of hosts." Yeah, pray before Yahweh the Father, and to seek the Yahshua, his son, which is a master of ceremony. He's the Yahshua of the host, which is the 144,000. He's the host. And they, well, these are the saints in the kingdom, including the saints in the house of David. I will go also. Yeah, and many people and strong nations shall come to seek the Yahshua of the host in Yahushua. Yahshua of hosts in Yahushua, and to pray before the Yahshua. Thus saith the Yahshua of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take a hold out of all languages of the nations, even shall take a hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. Zechariah 8:23. Obviously the Jew whose skirt that the people will take a hold of must be the one through whom the Yahshua is working to reveal himself and his truth to the people. So who is this? Antiochus Elijah, which is his servant David. It's Antiochus David in the spirit and power of the Elijah. Having discovered this particular Jew, this Jew is Elijah David now. So I'm going to tell you, I'm speaking to you right now. So folks, this is a coming right up to the present tense. In other words, we're in the quantum. Truth revolves upon itself. And truth, when you speak a word about a particular this or that, it could very be mean the very one that's speaking to you. Having discovered this particular Jew, of course, is not of the present day identified Jews, but most likely a descendant of the Christian Jews. Okay. Now let's just change this Christian to apostolic Jews. And then we can get closer to home to identifying the apostolic Jews as being the disciples. And so this Jew here in this last day that they take a hold of skirt of, that's Yahshua's visible helper, that he's placed in charge of his kingdom. Okay, so this most likely descendant of the apostolic congregation of the congregation of the Nazarenes that Yahshua set up as the head of this New Testament kingdom congregation. Perhaps for those who in the apostolic age lost their identity by naming themselves Christians. Well, the thing is, the early apostolics did not name themselves Christians. That was done by their enemy. Their enemy, the Greeks, the Greek Jews that hated the apostolic Jews. They hated them. And so they changed Yeshua's name to Christ. And then they said, well, all of those that are followers of this man that we've named or give a title. Actually, Christ is just a title. It's not even a name. So they dropped Yahshua's true name, and they just gave him a title called Christ. And where did they get the Christ from? It was taken from a oil that they, in the Latin, called Christo. Okay. And what they use for the Christo oil for, the pagans, what did they use it for? They use it for a sexual rubbing oil. So that's they disgraced Yahshua real good by changing the title, his title being the Messiah, that's the title. And they called him Christ, and then they said all those that followed him are Christians. In other words, they added a suffix, I-A-N, meaning coming out of the Christ era. Okay. So, and then they, instead of calling him Apostolic Nazarene, a creed of the Yahshua followers, the Greeks changed their name to Christians. And so, the Apostolic Jew did not voluntarily change his name. Why would he want to change his identity when Yahshua was the one that gave him his identity? Why would they want to change it? They didn't. It was the enemies that changed it. Okay? And you'll find it in Acts 11:26 where they were first called Christians at Antioch. Again, he may be a descendant of any of the Jews who were driven from their homeland, scattered throughout the nations and assimilated by them, then converted unto Christianity. 1 TGR 16, page 29. At this point, I want to say that there are four parts to a government. Number one, religious. Number two, civil. And number three, political. And number four, judicial. Now, this word religious is not the best hard noun to use to describe one of the four points of a government. But now, if you say spiritual, that would be better. Okay. But that's okay. Brother Johnson chose the word religious. So, in other words, he's saying that you got to have a religion. You got to have the moral code, the Decalogue of the Moses. You got to have the civil laws of the Moses. You got to have the political and judicial for the civil. Okay, Elohim told me that the only way that Texas can become an independent nation and to change its government from a de facto form of a government to a government under God. Now, there's another bad use of words. Under is outside of the quantum. It has no jurisdiction. God is a pagan name for Baal. So what did Brother Johnson say? To change his government from a de facto form of government to a government under Satan. This is really what Brother Johnson was saying. Because that's the terminology given to Satan, the god of this world. It was that pagan terminology, God, which means another name for identity for Baal. And it is to do this politically. Now here's the way he should have written it if he wanted to do it right. Change this government from a de facto, meaning that a man-made government with its own rules and regulations and own laws and own constitution, apart from the constitution of heaven, which would be translated through the law of Moses. That's what a de facto government is. A man-made laws and institutions that are contrary to the laws of Moses. So he says he had to change his government from a de facto form of government unto a government with, in conjunction with the heavens government, and pattern after a heavens government, with the pattern being demonstrated through the law of Moses. He has to do it politically. Okay, this is what Brother Johnson said. He has to change this government from a de facto form of government, okay, to a government under God. In other words, a de facto government is not a theocratic government, because the democratic government is a de facto government. It means that they misinterpret the separation of church and state, and so they want the state to completely rule over the moral, religious, and the civil. Okay, but they want the civil to be predominant, and not allow the religious to be practiced or taught. So that's your de facto government. But your theocratic government, I mean, your theocratic government, the theocracy, you have both the civil and the moral code of the Decalogue of Moses all joined together. This is why I am going political and dealing with the Texans. This is what Brother Johnson said. This is why I am going political and dealing with the Texans. So count your blessings, for I am doing it Elohim's way. He says God's way here. In other words, he's saying I'm doing it Satan's way, and that's how come Brother Johnson failed. Okay, I could give you a 18-month history of our dealings with the Republic of Texas, and I've got all of those letters that Brother Johnson wrote to the Republic of Texas, 17 of them, I believe, altogether, over a several years period of time. He wrote one for every 3 weeks on his time he started in 1996. And he said a lot of good stuff in those letters. But then it came time for Brother Johnson to take the helm and to be the president of the Republic of Texas, and he deferred to his son. That's what got Brother Johnson in the deep, deep water with heaven and with Yahweh. And that's what got his son, that's what put his son in the grave. But his son was a usurper, and his son was a belligerent, and that's another story. Let's go on. Brother Johnson is going on to say the question there arises, what is a referendum? The answer is the process of submitting a law already passed by the law-making body to a direct vote of the citizens for the approval or rejection. It says for the World Book Encyclopedia Dictionary, another definition for referendum is the right of the people to vote directly on such laws, superseding or overruling the legislature. Webster's Dictionary, this is what you call going political on an issue. You either have to put it to a vote or take it by the force. By making Texas an independent nation, it will give us a base of the operation for the Elohim's kingdom. Okay. He says for God's kingdom. Okay. This is so strange that Brother Johnson restored the sacred name in 1970, along with all the other divine institutions that was trampled underfoot by the man of sin during the Dark Ages, and yet he refused to use that sacred name. He would rather choose to use the title for Satan, which is another title for Baal, use this God, and he knew better. Okay. By making Texas an independent nation, it will give us a base of the operation for the Yahweh's kingdom. So Daniel 2:34-35, 44-45, can be fulfilled. This is the kingdom of David now coming forth here in this prophecy of Daniel 2:34-35, 44-45. A stone cut out of a mountain. There's another wrong play on words. It is not a stone, it's the little stone that's cut out of the mountain of the house of the Yahweh. And that mountain of the house of Yahweh was the Seventh-day Adventist church at the time. Okay, to drive it more directly straight to home, it was called the little stone hewn out of the mountain of Mount Gilead at Kermit, Texas in 2002, struck the image on the feet right there in that pulpit at Gilead Center. Okay. And then that's where it gets its launching pad from, after he strikes that image on the feet. Okay, now where was that image set up? Where did Nebuchadnezzar set his image up? In the plain of Dura, right there in the land of Babylon. Okay, so where's the antithetical image set up? In the antithetical plain of Dura, away from the city, out there in the wide open spaces, where you could have thousands of people come to the dedication and have enough room to stand around that great monument, that great image, in which Nebuchadnezzar did. He invited all the nations of the world that he was in charge of to come to this great dedication. So, this stone hewn out of the mountain without hand is the kingdom, everlasting kingdom of heaven. That starts as a grain of mustard seed in Matthew 13:31. And so now this stone cut out was the house of David, and with the antithetical David in charge of it. So, right before their eyes at Kermit, Texas, 2002, Yahweh was making a transition right there in the church building. He's making a transition from one leader to the other. And the one that announced that there's going to be a changing of the guard was a member of the church, Elijah David. In January 2002, I said there's going to be a changing of the guard starting at the Passover this year, 2002, in October. And he promptly told his wife the whole congregation. So this little stone hewn out of this mountain at Gilead Center, right there, on the Passover day, was hewn out. Okay, of 2002. Struck that image on the feet, and now this little stone is when it brings forth 144,000, then you will see that it has grown exponentially from the time that it was hewn out until it's, and that 144,000 comes forth, because when it comes forth, it's going to grow real fast and fill the whole earth, because they're commissioned to go all over the world to get their brethren and bring to this holy mountain, which is a little mountain right now. But whenever they start bringing and filling it up with the millions of people of their brethren, it's going to fill the whole earth, because there's going to be a remnant of all these people that are going to be left in all these nations, because and the wicked are destroyed out of all these nations will become righteous nations. Okay, so for a while the people are going to remain in their places. They're just going to come to this holy mountain and celebrate, but they've got to go back home, really. Because it says right there in Zechariah 14, after that war and that battle takes place, when Michael stands up, it says, Judah also shall fight at Jerusalem. And it says, and those that come not up of all the nations, of all the families of the earth, they don't come to keep the feast tabernacle, on them will be no rain, this will be the plague. So they are told to come up, those that are left of all the nations, in those nations. Alright? So it says a stone cut out of the mountain, which is the house of David at Gilead Center. That mountain was Gilead Center, representing the Adventist church. to come to the great mountain. A kingdom church, it says out here, that fills the whole earth, showing that the church, or the kingdom church, has to have a location from which to implement this rapid worldwide operation. And this location, Yahweh told verse, he brought him down here first in 1999 and 2000. He brought him right down here. No, 1997, 1998, when we were working with the Republic of Texas and all these different towns in Texas. He brought him right through here. Brother told him to stop the car one day, right out here in this Liberty Hill area. He said, this is where Yahweh says we're to move to. So this is the place for the base of operation where to take place. But Brother Johnson didn't know that it would be in the 12th hour, and that it would be with the 8th movement, and he was with the 7th movement at the time. So he didn't know, he didn't realize where the transition was about to take place. Okay, since the little stone kingdom was set up in the Kermit, Texas in 1974, it shows that the Texas is God's appointed nation from which the gospel of his kingdom will go out during the first phase of his kingdom. See 1TGR 15, page 11, and 1TGR 41, page 27, etc., etc. Well, we know that this never happened, and I can't understand why Brother Johnson is 24 years after 1974, 1998, is writing this stuff. It never made its fulfillment. Nothing ever happened from it. Why would he write this and try to insist that this was a true prophecy and that these things actually took place? Okay. In researching, let's continue on with his writing. In researching the archives, it was found that through a joint resolution, the U.S. Legislature of 1845 annexed the Republic of Texas, and what's more, without the requisite number of votes. In other words, they annexed Texas by a joint resolution of Congress rather than having the full House and the Senate to vote on it with the majority. Okay, that was illegal. Another thing, when a nation is in bankruptcy, it is unconstitutional for one nation to annex another nation when they're in bankruptcy. The United States have been in bankruptcy ever since the birth of the Constitution in 1790. When our forefathers met and adopted the Constitution of this country, around 1790, whenever they signed that Constitution, they agreed to pay Britain money that Britain caused in 1776. They had it set up to where Britain was in charge of this Constitution of this country. And when our forefathers signed it, they were agreeing to a document and a contract to pay Britain back, I think, about $17 million for that war of 1776, that they come over here and attack the colonies and try to take this country from the colonies. The colonies won the battle, but nevertheless, Britain had worked it around by the 1790 that they were demanding. And so automatically, whenever you're put in debt for a war debt, your country has to go into bankruptcy until you pay that debt. And they said you can only be in bankruptcy for 70 years, and then after 70 years, the debt is forgiven if you haven't paid it. Whatever's left of it, if you haven't paid it, it's forgiven. But unless you start another war, then you're out of bankruptcy. So the bankruptcy was over in 1860, and lo and behold, they were preparing for another war, the Civil War, with Abraham Lincoln at the head of it. So whenever Abraham Lincoln started the Civil War in 1861, put the nation of United States back under bankruptcy. And they remained under bankruptcy until 1930, when they had Wall Street broke and fell, and we went into the Great Depression. The bankruptcy then was forgiven. But because we went into a Great Depression, then they put us under debt to a new monetary system, and the new president took away our gold, Franklin Roosevelt, and our silver, and gave us fiat money, phony money, and so it put us under bankruptcy again. Okay, and it's called war on poverty. Anytime you have a declaration of war, I don't care what it's on, war on disease, war on poverty, or whatever, and you put the country back under bankruptcy because you got to borrow money to fight that war with, and that automatic. So Texas was under bankruptcy. I mean, the United States under bankruptcy when Texas became an independent nation. So, in 1845, Texas was under bankruptcy, and what she did was totally illegal, annexing another nation. But it's totally unconstitutional. Even if the United States wasn't under bankruptcy, even if they weren't under bankruptcy, it's still unconstitutional for one nation to annex another nation. You just don't do that. Now, you can annex a state, you see, but you can't annex a nation. All right, let's go on. So it says, also, there was no provision in the U.S. Constitution or in the laws of the U.S., nor in the Constitution of the Republic of Texas to allow for annexing a sovereign nation into another nation, whether or not the people of other nations desired it. John Quincy Adams recorded his opinion at that time that it would be unlawful to annex Texas or any other sovereign nation into the United States. Thus it is the consensus of many Texans, seeing that it is in their minds that Texas has the right to pull out of the union of the state, that this unlawful act should be corrected by again making Texas an independent nation. Well, I'd like to say right now that our leaders today here in Texas, our governor and attorney general and railroad commissioner, are already working together, and our Congress and our Senate are working together right now to pull Texas away from the Union and make them a sovereign nation right now. They're working on it right now. So this policy has been fulfilled here now in 2014. Brother Johnson tried to show that this being fulfilled in 1998 when he wrote this tract. Okay, but, and so you just, 16 years later, now we begin to see the move toward the fulfillment of this here, making Texas a independent nation, sovereign nation. For the act of the dissolving Texas illegal annexation will restore our country's sovereignty. A sovereignty based on 100% of God's law. There you go again, that pagan term. 100% of the Yahweh's law, and not that of the politic of a democracy. Now, democracy is another name for communism, whether you realize that or not. 51% of the vote determines who rules in the country. And so that is communism. That is mob rule, in other words. That's not a great republic. Republic is set upon the moral or law of Yahweh, the Moses, and the civil laws of the law of Moses. That's the republic. It's not supposed to be democratic, it's supposed to be republic. A democracy manifests the following traits, as so well written by the Joseph Sobran, a syndicated columnist, in his column entitled The Insolubility of Politics. The late Henry Hastert, a disciple of the great Ludwig von Mises, was a classical liberal or a libertarian, as we'd now say, and an incisive critic of the modern centralized state. His little classic Economics in One Lesson is a model of this, showing the simple principle at the heart of the complex issues. Hastert died at the age of 99 in 1993, but he has reappeared in a new book left unfinished at his death, edited by Felix R. Livingston and published by the Foundation for the Economic Education. His title is Politics Insoluble. Hastert's answer to that question is pessimistic, yes. Why? Because of the very nature of the politics. In a democracy where all sorts of group demands of legislation favoring themselves, laws are easy to pass and nearly impossible to repeal. Since its beginning, Hastert observes Congress has enacted more than 40,000 laws. It is a fair assumption that most of these are still operative in some form. He cites a 1968 study by a congressional staff that concluded that no one anywhere knows exactly how many federal programs there are. The rate of the legislation and spending is always accelerating to meet the demand for the special favors. Hastert quotes Frederick dictum, the state is the great fiction by which everybody tries to live at the expense of everybody else. The logic of the situation dooms us to constantly encroaching tyranny, not Stalin style, but one paraphrase has us loosely here, pain in the butt style, for the piling up of the petty laws and regulation is bound to continue indefinitely, gradually choking off freedom of action and eventually even freedom of speech and thought. Hastert's love of the principle and distilled expression show both in what he says and in what he quotes. Many of his best citations concern the perversion of the democracy into a system of what Bastet called organized plunder, and of the preventing of voting into the larceny by the other means. While the good citizen who dutifully obeys the law and pays his taxes asking no favors for himself because or becomes a victim of a venal politic. For the British historian Alexander Tyler observed, a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can exist only until the voters discover that they can vote themselves largest out of the public treasury. For the British economic philosopher Herbert Spencer warned that in a pure democracy, people who don't pay taxes would be free to vote themselves a generous share of other people's money. Okay. During the days when the extensions of the franchise were in agitation, a maxim perpetuity repeated was taxation without representation is robbery. Experience has since made it clear that, on the other hand, representation without a taxation entails robbery. Spencer noted that the increase of the freedom and the form has been followed by the decrease of freedom in the fact. Spencer again, all socialism involves slavery, that which fundamentally distinguishes the slave is that he labors under the coercion to satisfy another's desires. When some citizens use the franchise to enrich themselves at others' expense, involuntary servitude has merely taken a new form. Chattel slavery may be gone, but the state can become the instrument of the same general purpose of enabling some to live by the labor of others. As Spencer puts it, the essential question is, how much is the individual compelled to labor for other benefits than his own, and how much can he labor for his own benefit? Spencer formulated the operative principle of the modern democracy, that no man has any claim to his property, not even to that which he has earned by the sweat of his brow, save by the permission of the community, and that the community may cancel the claim to any extent it sees fit. Hastert himself amplifies this point. For the government may pass and enforce any law it sees fit, guided only by what it regards as the merit of the individual case, and no part of any citizen of freedom or property shall be respected. If a majority of the 51%, there's your 51%, or more decide otherwise, let Spencer provide the coda. The function of the liberalism in the past was that of the putting a limit to the power of the kings. It says, for the function of the true liberalism is in the future, or in the future, will be that of the putting a limit unto the power of the parliament. Unfortunately, even the word liberalism has now become a synonym for statism. Sobram is an author, regular magazine contributor, and a former college professor who lives in Arlington, Virginia. And now the last part of Brother Johnson's tract, and we're not going to have time to finish it, is called The Benefits of Yahweh's Government. So we're going to save that for our next study. And we're going to make a few comments and then bring this study to a close. What we are learning is that Brother Johnson is advanced far enough to where he saw this great nation of Texas coming back from a captive nation status to become an independent sovereign nation once again, as it always has been a sovereign nation. It's always been an independent nation, even though six different countries or six different entities have ruled over Texas for over a 300-year period. But now, so Brother Johnson had a chance. He was given the first opportunity to be a president of the Republic of Texas. Yahweh gave him a sign, and I interpreted the sign, and I told him that exactly what the sign would be to show that he was to be appointed as the president. And lo and behold, he took and acted on that sign. The first sermon he preached at Tournament, Texas, after we went to that El Paso meeting of the Republic of Texas and got that sign about that flag that day I told you about earlier. I told Brother Salvin, you're going to win that flag, and you're going to be the fifth one called, and that's going to be a sign that's just supposed to be the head of this Republic of Texas. So Brother Johnson came home and he preached on the Sabbath day. He said, well, we're going to kick off a headquarters from here, and I'm going to be the head of it, and that's clear now. That's clear from heaven. That's the word. And boy, his two sons got upset because David Johnson had already had a constitution drawn up for him to become the Republic of Texas president, and we were supposed to have a meeting in another city 400 miles away. And so he told Brothers, he said, you can't do that. You can't do that. Him and Daniel both. Brothers said, well, okay, we'll do it your way then. We won't kick it off. Yahweh told me to kick it off here and turn it, make this our headquarters and make me the head of it and so forth. But you say that you don't want it. So Brother Johnson give in to them. And that's how come David ended up becoming the president instead of Brother Johnson, because he gave in to him. And David set himself up as the president of the Republic of Texas, because he was kicked out from his last time that he's appointed as president. So he just reappointed himself and drew up in him a constitution, and he called people to come to the dedication and the inauguration of him being the president of the great Republic of Texas. And so Rodas was there backing him up, and at that town in Greenville, Texas. And so therefore the rest is history. It all fell in a heap, and it dissolved and came to nothing. And David Johnson went to the grave, and Brother Johnson went to the bankruptcy, and he cried out for my help to save the church's property in Tremont, because they were after all of his property, because he had put it up as collateral for this venture of David Johnson. His son went into his own personal business, and he put up church money for it, and also put up the collateral for all the church's property. And then he called upon and cried upon me to help him save it. And I was able to do it. And then he wouldn't turn the keys over to me after I had told him that Yahweh said he's to turn the keys over, because he had lost it by default, and I had retrieved and saved it with Yahweh's help. And so that all the keys of the property belonged to me, and he refused to turn them over. So Yahweh brought him to his end, to separate us down there in Kermit, Texas, brought him to his end, and dissolved all his property, and the city got all his property. He lost every bit of it, even down to the car that he was driving. He ended up in a nursing home, and he died in a nursing home. So that pretty much sums it up about that situation. Now we're going to bring the study to a close, and we're going to have it with a song. Sweet Hour of Prayer. Sweet Hour of Prayer, Sweet Hour of Prayer, that calls me from a world of care, and bids me at my Father's throne make all my wants and wishes known. In seasons of distress and grief, my soul has often found relief, and oft escaped the tempter's snare. And I return, sweet hour of prayer, hour of prayer, sweet hour of prayer, thy wings shall my petition bear. To him who's true and faithfulness engage the waiting soul to bless. And since he bids me seek his face, believe his word and trust his grace, I'll cast on him my every care and wait for thee, sweet hour of prayer. Sweet hour of prayer, sweet hour of prayer, that I thy consolation share. If from the piteous lofty height I view my home and take my flight, this robe of flesh shall drop and rise, who sees the everlasting fire.